Good afternoon. We are back in studio after a long layoff for football season. Tom Schroyer, good enough to join us in studio today, the president of Moss and Barnett. Happy holidays, Tom. Good to see you.
Thank you, Steve. It is really fun to be back, and now we are looking forward to, of course, continuing our program here on a regular basis after a happy interruption for Gopher football season in the new stadium at the TCF Bank Stadium. And it's appropriate we're here today on what looks to be like the turning point for starting winter to talk about the impact in the workplace of H1N1. And in that regard, we have with us our Moss and Barnett senior shareholder, Dave Jendrzejek, who is very experienced in working with employment law-related litigation and advising businesses on employment law matters, as well as a variety of other highly complex civil types of litigation. Dave, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
I know you've been on several times before talking about a variety of topics, including non-competes, unfair competition law as well. But now today we're switching with you to talking a bit about employment law and specifically focusing on the H1N1 outbreak.
That's right, Tom. The H1N1 outbreak continues to be a serious concern. And this is a good time to talk about issues related to the workplace as it affects that outbreak and what employers can do and what they can't do with that in mind.
Yes, and even though employers may not all be afflicted by contagions in their workforce of the H1N1, and indeed we'll talk in a minute about the appearance that the contagion or the pandemic appears to be abating a bit, but nonetheless, this is really an interesting way to start a dialogue with our listeners in mind about how health issues interact with and intersect with the really complex mosaic of the employment laws.
That's true, Tom. The H1N1 outbreak is merely one example of the kinds of medical issues that affect the workplace. It has some special aspects to it, but there are many other similar medical contexts that come up in the workplace every day.
All right, so we'll be using H1N1 then as a bit of a proxy to work our way through on a practical level these complex quilt-like pattern of employment laws that affect us in so many different ways. Now, I understand there's been a bit of a break in the pandemic, at least in Minnesota.
That's true, at least according to the authorities, Tom. The news is both good and bad. On Wednesday, the state health department reported that the number of H1N1 flu cases in Minnesota has declined now for the fifth straight week. That's good news, and that does suggest that the current wave of the outbreak has peaked. No schools or long-term health care facilities reported outbreaks during the past week, which is a good thing, and the severity of the pandemic has been downgraded from widespread to local, according to state authorities, primarily because the outbreak is largely confined to northwestern Minnesota. However, the number of deaths attributed to H1N1 strain continue to remain high. For example, and I'll just give you a few statistics here, during the past week, 10 more deaths associated with the flu have been confirmed statewide. 7 of those were H1N1-associated deaths. And since the outbreak began, some 44 deaths have been reported, 19 of them confirmed H1N1 cases. So it continues to be a serious matter, and there continue to be fatalities that result from the outbreak. Not only that, Tom, but the hospitalizations continue to remain high. Since September 1st, there have been over 1,500 confirmed H1N1 hospitalizations. That's a lot. It's a serious illness.
I know that the vaccine is just becoming available now to folks in protected classes or vulnerable categories, and so hopefully that will help to further abate this. But they're still talking about perhaps a third wave of the epidemic or pandemic, as it were, reaching another crescendo here in the winter.
That is the concern of health authorities. We've gone through two waves already. There may be a third coming up that we'll have to face in January or February. And not only that, there's also the concern at this point in time that the regular seasonal flu is now beginning to make its appearance here in the state, and it's only going to get worse as time goes on.
All right, so we've set the stage with a classic example of a pandemic and one that involves a highly contagious disease. And now we're going to focus on the workplace, where people work closely together and have a lot of contact with commonly touched objects, so that the highly infectious disease can be easily spread and rapidly spread. And that could have devastating consequences for any employer if a large segment of their workforce is forced to stay at home and not be able to report to duty because of H1N1.
That's true. And with this outbreak, as with similar medical type issues, employers are facing, in my view, two critical problems. Number one, perhaps it's obvious, but it's the absenteeism issue. How does an employer handle absenteeism? How does the employer properly staff its needs? And how does it deal with the employees and workers, particularly when it concerns issues of sick time and being absent from work? How do they get done the business of that needs to get done?
Sure, on the other side of the token, employees have a legitimate concern in not being afflicted with this disease by their coworkers, who may be acting irresponsibly by coming to work when they are contagious.
Yes, the contagious workplace is the other major issue that employers face. The problem of sick employees coming to work and spreading the infection to their coworkers is a real concern. And employers have to walk that fine line between maintaining a normal work environment and respecting the privacy rights of its employees. At the same time, they've got to maintain a healthy and safe work environment. That's not easy to do with this type of illness.
All right. We'll be talking throughout the program then about the legal issues that apply here, giving our listeners some do's and don'ts, and also addressing some practical issues. This is going to be a great program, Steve, for listeners to call or text our program.
And the number is on the program, Tom, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. It is a toll-free line for outside the Twin Cities metro area, wherever you're hearing the program. Our text line open as well, 81807. That's 81807. That's powered by Wellington Window and Door. It is Minnesota law, H1N1 in the workplace. What can and you can't do? That's coming up here on Minnesota Law News Radio 830 WCCO. Welcome back to Minnesota Law, each and every Saturday at noon, presented by Moss and Barnett, available online at moss-barnett.com. There's an archive of previous shows and more information on today's topic as well online. Once again, H1N1 in the workplace, what you can and can't do. Tom Schreier, host Dave Jendrzejek in studio today. A great topic. By the way, if you want to be a part of the show, feel free to call 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. The text line open as well, 81807. Send your text to 81807. That's powered by Wellington Window and Door Company. Let's go to Peter. Peter, welcome to the program. Hello.
Hey, I was wondering if you're an employee that does not have sick time or sick benefits, you come to work, but the employer deems you someone who should not be at work that day and sends you home, is at that point the employer responsible for pay for that day?
Well, you've put your finger immediately on one of the big problems that employers and employees face with this issue. The general rule is that employees who are paid on an hourly basis would not have to be paid for the time that they would miss as a result of being sent home. The employer, in connection with its ability to maintain a safe workplace, does have the right to send home employees that appear to be sick, that may be contagious, and affect other workers in the workplace. And if that employee happens to be one who's an hourly worker and one who has, for example, used up all of his or her sick pay, can be sent home. And technically speaking, the employer is not obligated to pay that lost wage. There are differences, I should mention, for employees who are salaried employees, employees who are exempt under the Fair Labor Standards Act from the overtime requirements. There's a different standard that applies to them. That is a standard that's based on the length of time that the employee may be out as well as whether or not the leave, regardless of the duration, is covered by the FMLA. The FMLA, the Family and Medical Leave Act, is the federal statute which guarantees an employee the right to be gone for medical-related purposes and allows, rather guarantees the employee the right to return after the illness has abated. But absent the FMLA applicability, absent a salaried employee situation, the employer would not have to pay that wage.
Dave, that does seem to be disparate to me, a little bit unfair. Why should an hourly worker suffer that penalty, whereas a salaried worker, by law, is prohibited from enduring that that issue?
Well, it is a difference, but it's an outgrowth of the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act, and it does create a different standard for those employees.
I know that when you were researching for our program here today, you came up with really quite a long litany of different laws that govern the issues we're going to be talking about here today, and you've already mentioned a couple of them.
There are a number of laws, and as you mentioned at the outset, Tom, it's really quite a complicated mosaic of overlapping federal and state laws that apply to this situation. I already mentioned the Family and Medical Leave Act, the FMLA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, the ADA, which prohibits discrimination based on disability, has repercussions. So does Title VII, the federal statute prohibiting discrimination. OSHA has applicability. I mentioned the Fair Labor Standards Act. And there are also several different state laws that also apply. One of them is the Minnesota Human Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination in the workplace. The Minnesota Sick or Injured Child Care Leave Act also could potentially apply. Now, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to ask. I assume that these laws, the ones you just mentioned, come into play when a child is stricken with H1N1 or a close family member.
Well, that's true. Both the FMLA in particular does allow the employee to be gone not only for medical issues that concern the employee, if the employee is sick, but also if a dependent or family member is sick.
Well, what's an employer to do as a practical matter? They can't be calling a lawyer every time they have to turn around on this issue. Are there some common themes that apply to these various laws as they intersect here with our H1N1 in the workplace example?
Well, each of these laws, of course, is different, but the thrust of the laws in general is to allow employees to be absent from work for specified times and for certain medical-related reasons if the employee meets the eligibility requirements. I should point out that each of these laws, while they offer benefits to employees, also contain eligibility requirements. And I'm speaking here of the length of time that the employee must be employed with the employer, the size of the employer, and similar requirements.
Oh, take the FMLA or Family Medical and Leave Act, for example. What are the requirements there for eligibility?
Well, the eligibility requirements for the employee are that the employee must have worked for the employer for at least 1 year before the leave takes place, the FMLA leave. In addition, the employer has to have worked at least 1,250 hours during the preceding 12 months. And as well, the employer must be one that employs at least 50 or more employees. If it's a small employer, Tom, employing perhaps 10 or 15 employees, the FMLA requirements simply do not apply.
And there's no state law counterpart, I gather.
There is no state law counterpart.
All right. So under FMLA, is H1N1 sufficient to trigger coverage? Is it a serious health condition?
The answer is it depends. It depends on the severity of the case of H1N1. There have been a wide variety of severity cases reported. Sometimes the H1N1 case is very severe. Sometimes it is simply comparable to typical seasonal flu-like symptoms. And the real issue for FMLA is whether the H1N1 case might constitute what the statute calls a serious health condition. Well, what's that? That is a condition that either requires hospitalization or continuing treatment by some health care provider for an incapacitation that lasts at least 3 consecutive days. And when we speak of continuing treatment in this regard, what we're talking about is either 2 in-person doctor visits or 1 doctor visit followed by some kind of treatment regimen, such as a prescription medication.
All right, we have much more coming up on the program. Tom Schroyer, our host. Dave Jendrzak in studio. H1N1 in the workplace. What you can and can't do. Phone lines are open, 651-989-9226. Toll free, 1-866-989-9226 are the phone numbers. You can text the studio as well, 81807. That's 81807. It's Minnesota Law each and every Saturday at noon here on News Radio, 830-WCCO. Welcome back. Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Available online at moss-barnett.com. Information about each and every show, including podcasts available of each and every show. That's moss-barnett.com. Tom Schroyer, our host today. Dave Jendrzak in studio. H1N1 in the workplace. What you can and can't do. And during the break, I brought up there aren't many public places where hand sanitizer isn't readily available. I think every reception desk I've seen, the lobby here has sanitizer available. So businesses are stepping up and trying to do something on prevention, at least.
Well, prevention is awfully important, and that gets into an area that the Federal Center for Disease Control, the CDC, has recommended for employers. That is to take the common sense, easy steps to try and prevent the spread of H1N1 in the workplace. And there's so many things that they can do just like that. Not only hand sanitizers, but encouraging employees to wash their hands, covering their coughs and sneezes, and things of that nature. They're easy steps, and yet they can be very effective in preventing the spread of the disease in the workplace.
Well, Dave, that begs the question as to how far can an employer go in pushing this point? Can they force people to get vaccinated? Can they mandate that people wash their hands every time they walk past a washroom and things like that? Is that permissible or illegal?
Well, it's not the kind of directive that we normally see from employers. While it's encouraged, while the CDC, for example, would encourage employers to take those steps and encourage their employees to wash hands, it's another thing to actually direct employees that they always must take those steps. And the area of vaccinations creates particular problems.
Such as?
Well, the whole issue of vaccination, some would argue employers would have the right to require their employees to be vaccinated as a condition of employment. And one could foresee situations in the healthcare industry in particular where that may be a requirement. However, for the typical employer, it's a different story. And while there isn't any specific statute on the books that might directly prohibit that, the problem is that it creates other issues and potential problems, not only related to possible disability discrimination and privacy issues, but other complications that could arise if that mandate were put into place. For example, there is a shortage of vaccines. At this point in time, employees can't even get vaccinated if they wanted to. And in addition, there's the secondary issue of possible liability. What happens if the employee gets sick from being vaccinated? Those problems result in a general conclusion that it's simply not a good idea to require employees to get vaccinated.
And I imagine if it is not a bona fide occupational qualification to have the vaccination, such as might be the case at a hospital or a health clinic, it might trigger religious discrimination issues.
That is potentially true. And any time that employees would be singled out, for example, for different treatment, if an employer would require some employees to be vaccinated while others were not, or any different treatment, that raises the issue of discrimination in the workplace. And that's of potential concern in this situation. You may recall that originally the outbreak began with cases of individuals who either came from Mexico or who had recently visited. And so there was some concern about employers somehow singling out individuals of Mexican descent with respect to special treatment. That clearly would be prohibited as discriminatory.
Now, I know that employers and, in fact, our law firm, for example, have taken a number of proactive steps to try to head off this potential threat. And in our case, for example, we relaxed, as it were, the paid time off leave policy to provide folks with a bit of an incentive, or at least without penalizing them for being honest and forthright and participating by not calling or by not coming to work when they have H1N1.
That's an important thing for employers to keep in mind to try to do themselves. Of course, one of the best ways to reduce the spread of H1N1 is to keep the sick people away from the well people. And that means the employees who are sick ought to be encouraged to stay home. Someone who shows up at work that's infected could infect as many as 10 other workers. And so, again, employers should be encouraged, and should encourage their own employees who are sick to stay home and not to come to work.
All right, so let's say somebody is at work and they're hacking away. Is that cold? Is it H1N1? Who knows? Can the employer ask about specific symptoms when they observe someone in the workplace who appears, by outward appearances, I should say, to have some sort of an infectious disease or sickness?
Well, yes, they can ask about symptoms, and unfortunately, all that employers have to go on is symptoms. There really is no easy test for H1N1, and so employers have to be observant, and they have to watch for how their employees are behaving in the workplace. If, for example, an employee comes to work, obviously incapacitated, perhaps with a fever, cough, sore throat, an employer does have the right to ask that employee about symptoms.
And what, on the flip side, what if an employee takes time off and says, well, I'm not feeling well and I need a week to recover? Can the employer require a note from the doctor? Can there be some sort of medical proof or some sort of documentation?
Well, the simple answer is yes, the employer could require such a doctor's note, but there are different schools of thought about whether that's a good idea. On the one hand, the employer wants to make sure that the employees are off for valid, legitimate reasons, and requiring a doctor's note would be a good way to ensure that. On the other hand, doctors' offices are very busy these days, and particularly if the outbreak would take a turn for the worse, those employees simply are not going to be able to timely produce a doctor's note to be able to get back into work. So it's a double-edged sword. It's a difficult issue for many employers to decide how to handle. But in the main, we would recommend that employers not require the note simply because it would create another obstacle to the employees returning. And keep in mind that many of the workers who have H1N1, they aren't actually being tested. They may have it, they may not have it, but the additional step of going to the doctor and getting that note is simply another obstacle to returning.
Is it necessary then for employers who want to liberalize their paid time off leave policies or other employment policies, is it important for them to have that reduced to a writing, or should they proceed on an ad hoc basis and simply act in reaction to circumstances?
We recommend that the employer reduces to writing in some fashion what that new policy is going to be, and that's important. That way, the employee knows where he or she stands, and the employer knows exactly what rules are going to govern the workplace. And there are different ways to handle that, too, Tom. It may well be that the employer may decide simply to offer some additional paid sick leave days, perhaps with a cap of some sort. Another good way that we recommend is that employers offer the ability of the employee to take an advance on sick days, even if they're out of sick days, to allow them to take an advance on sick days that they could then pay back at a later time. That way, ensuring to the employee that they would be gone, have the right to be gone if they are sick, without fear of losing their job.
Now, we've talked a lot about the employer's rights here to, for example, find out about symptoms, to direct employees to remain at home, and even without pay in some cases. How about employees, co-employees? Do they have rights to be protected as well against the appearance at work of somebody who's sick? Maybe they don't want to take a day off, but they come in and they're hacking around and exposing folks to a possible infection. Do employees have any rights in this situation?
Well, the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA, certainly mandates that employers maintain a safe workplace that's free of hazards and is a safe workplace. And an employer arguably has obligations under OSHA to be careful and take the steps we're talking about to ensure that other workers are not infected. Now, as a practical matter, it's going to be impossible for employers to eliminate the risk of infection. The fact is, with H1N1, people who have the disease are contagious even before they're symptomatic, And the touchstone symptom of H1N1, that being a fever of 100 degrees or more, is not one that everyone shows. And so you can't tell on the basis of symptoms alone when someone truly has H1N1. You're not going to be able to keep H1N1 out of the workplace entirely. It's simply not possible.
All right. So let's say an employee finds or has a coworker who is, let's say, coughing or demonstrating some symptoms of illness, or maybe even is saying something about that. Can the employer go ask the person who is potentially carrying the disease or the sickness exactly what their symptoms are and get enough information to perhaps even confirm a diagnosis, at least on that kind of a basis?
Yes, they can, and they should. The fact is, in order to maintain a safe workplace, the employer ought to be sending home employees who are demonstrably sick, who have the kind of symptoms we're talking about that may be H1N1, as a precaution and to protect the co-workers.
That sounds to me to fly in the face of everything I've understood about the right to privacy, particularly around medical issues and especially in the workplace.
Well, now, I'm not saying that the information that's obtained by the employer is something that then can be shared. The fact is, whatever information the employer would receive about symptoms must be treated as confidential medical information and subject to the same kind of very careful protections as any other medical information that the employer may have.
Our phone number on the program, 651-989-9226, or toll-free 1-866-989-9226. If you have a question or comment for Tom and Dave, feel free to call the program today. Our text line is open as well. You can text a question or comment to 81807. That's 81807, and that's powered by Wellington Window and Door Company. You're listening to Minnesota Law, presented by Morris and Barnett, here on News Radio 830 WCCO. Welcome back to Minnesota Law, presented by Morris and Barnett, available online at morris-barnett.com. Information about today's program and previous shows, podcasts available online. That's morris-barnett.com. Final segment of the program already. Tom Scheuer and Dave Jendrzak in studio. H1N1 in the workplace, what you can and can't do.
And that's our topic exactly right. And so we're going to end it with our final segment here, talking with Dave Jendrzak about some practical do's and don'ts for employers to try to help them out with some practical advice and in this difficult situation.
Tom, the place to start on the practical do's and don'ts is to advise clients and advise businesses to develop a plan for dealing with H1N1 and similar type outbreaks. If you haven't already done it, you need to sit down and go through and make a list of the things that need to be done to plan for and deal with H1N1 in the workplace. Now, the CDC has issued a very helpful set of guidelines, came out just on October 21st, a guidance for businesses and employers to plan for and respond to the 2009-2010 influenza season.
Is that available online?
It is available online at the CDC's website at www.cdc.gov, and it contains a list of helpful suggestions, not only for the current outbreak, given its current level of severity, but also good suggestions for what to do if the outbreak becomes much more serious, as it certainly could do. If it does, that would entail much more serious planning by employers, things such as perhaps even daily screenings of employees coming to work, social distancing in the workplace, separating employees, and things of that nature.
Is it permissible for an employer looking down the road to try to survey or screen employees around issues like who has potentially more exposure at home for contracting the illness, or who may have to be absent because of relationships within the family if their family is hit with the outbreak?
Well, we don't advocate that employers treat employees differently just because, for example, they may have children or other members in the household who may be more likely to become exposed to the virus. Obviously, that has to be done on a case-by-case basis, and it's the employee's situation that is paramount.
All right. So there are laws that protect that privacy of that issue?
That's correct.
All right. And I know we've talked about some practical things employers can do, and many are doing, such as with the hand sanitizing and, as you point out, social distancing and just general education and awareness. How about from a legal standpoint? Are there any other particular steps that ought to be taken?
Well, as we talked about, the primary thing is to develop a plan for dealing with absenteeism. And if that means modifying the current sick leave program that the employer may have, that should be done. And what the CDC is advocating and what we think is also a good common sense approach is to be flexible. It's good for the employer to be flexible and agile in this environment and be able to respond to modify perhaps its normal requirements to accommodate the particular needs of this outbreak.
But it is important to put that in writing, that an employer create a consistent policy for the entire staff.
Yes, that's absolutely essential, Steve, not only so that everyone knows exactly where they stand and what an employee can and cannot do, when they're allowed to be gone and when they're not, but it simply also helps the employer to be consistent and avoid issues of discriminatory treatment of its employees. Consistency is very important.
Certainly, even-handedness in applying policies across all classes and categories of individuals is key here, isn't it, Dave?
Absolutely. Remember that just because there is an outbreak of H1N1, that doesn't absolve the employer from responsibility in complying with the discrimination laws, both state and federal.
It's also useful, I think, for employers to know and understand in this context, especially and as it relates in other similar situations, that they do have the right to temper and mitigate their what otherwise seem like really quite straitjacketed and rigid PTO policies, but they must do that around a plan and communicate that in writing.
Exactly right. And as we talked about, it does need to be even-handed. It does need to apply to all employees. But it's a good idea in this environment. Otherwise, employers who have, for example, very strict attendance policies may be faced with the prospect of having to deal with, perhaps terminate, employees who may have missed an extra day or two beyond the sick leave they already have. It's difficult to let a good employee go just to comply with a policy, particularly given the magnitude of this outbreak.
And so in terms of termination, I know that's a very harsh remedy and it certainly is very, very difficult, especially in times like this with high unemployment. But at the end of the day, the employer has that ultimate right to terminate at-will employees, that is to say those who are not subject to some kind of a contract that provides them with any particular job protection.
Well, that is true. And part of that is the issue of compliance with bona fide valid attendance policies. The employer does have the right to terminate if the employee does not meet those attendance requirements.
And then in an extreme case, the employer may feel constrained to use that ultimate power to protect the health and safety of other workers if somebody is just incorrigible in terms of not wanting to comply with these really quite common sense, practical policies that are implemented for the good of everyone.
Well, that's right. Now, fortunately, in our experience, there's been a fair amount of goodwill that exists between the employer and the employees in this context. Let's face it, we're all in this together, and maintaining that goodwill and treating the employees in a fair and even-handed way is the best way. It's the best business practice I can think of.
And in fact, at the end of the day, that's really good legal advice, I think, that that we always try to focus on as well when we're dealing with our clients.
Well, that's exactly right. It's a matter of treating people fairly and treating them consistently.
And I think those are good commandments on which to end this program, Steve. We're really excited again to be back for another go-around here for the winter and into the summer and spring of Minnesota law.
Once again, Minnesota Law, Tom Schroyer, our host, Dave Jendrzak in studio today. H1N1 in the workplace, what you can and can't do. For a podcast of this program, check it out online, moss-barnett.com. Once again, great to see you, Dave. Next week on the show, Tom, we've got a great program. Should be a lot of fun.
We're going to talk about the power of cross-examination. A lot of attention paid to that lately, especially here locally with the Petters trial.
Tom's going to cross-examine me on the program. It could get very interesting.
It will be.
I better clean the skeletons out of the closet this week. All right, that's Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett here on News Radio 830 WCCO.